Speaking on the program at this time is Brother James W. Boyd.
Continue tonight our study of the early history of the Lord's Church from the book of Acts. The inspired revelation concerning the establishment of the church and the events that surrounded the brethren of the early days. Tonight we will focus attention on the 23rd chapter of Acts, which is a chapter in the midst of the record of the activities about the Apostle Paul. As we come to the 23rd chapter, Paul is in grave difficulty. He had come to Jerusalem. He had pacified the brethren in Jerusalem concerning what he had taught. He had only antagonized the Jewish people, however, in Jerusalem about the things that he taught. And they had created a tumult and a riot against him, so much so that he had to be rescued for his very life's sake. At which time, and we studied last week, he was given an opportunity to explain to this mob that was calling for his death what he had done and why. Actually, what Paul did, instead of making some kind of personal defense of himself, he simply reiterated to those people there his conversion and what he and what all must do in order to be saved. He did bring out how that God had called him to be sent to the Gentiles, at which time, why, the people then threw themselves into a maddened, wild mob, and Paul had to be carried away by the Roman authorities. They were about to scourge him, and thinking that he was an Egyptian, they were about to beat him untried, but Paul let them know that he was a Roman, and therefore it would have been unlawful for them to have punished him before he had been condemned. The next day, the Roman authorities determined that Paul would go before the leaders of the Jewish people and give answer to their charges. And that's what we have here in the 23rd chapter. Paul before what is probably the most august ruling body among the Jews that there ever was, and that is called, though not called in the scriptures, it is called by Jewish writers as the Sanhedrin. Now notice how Paul begins his comments to this council. Men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day. And I'm provoked to ask, how could he say that? How could he say that he had lived in good conscience all of his life, and look what he had been doing before he became a Christian? He had been persecuting the church. He had been consenting to the death of Christians. He had given his voice to destroy them. He was even on the way to Damascus when the Lord appeared unto him in order to seize the Christians there and bind them and put them into prison. And yet he could say, everything I've done in good conscience. It was because consciences are things that are trained. People sometimes say, let your conscience be your guide. Well, Paul let his conscience be his guide, and it caused him to sin against Christ. Consciences are not a reliable guide by themselves. Consciences have to be taught what is right. Sometimes people are inclined to excuse their errors and the errors of others by saying, well, he really doesn't realize that he's doing wrong. Well, friend, whether a person realizes or not, that's not the standard by which we determine what is right and what is wrong. How a person feels about what he's doing does not determine what is right and what is wrong. The Apostle Paul felt like he was doing right when he was making havoc of the church, but he was wrong. And the Apostle Paul, therefore, could say, I've lived in good conscience. But because he had always acted according to his convictions. Now there were times in his life when his convictions were wrong. And that's what caused him to do what was wrong. But he couldn't just dismiss it by saying, well, I was honest. I was sincere. I didn't realize I was doing anything wrong. I didn't think I was doing anything wrong, but he was. But nonetheless, he made this statement, and it angered the high priest named Ananias, who also must have thought, how in the world can this man say that he's lived in good conscience because he has forsaken Judaism? He has turned to Christianity. How could he possibly contend he's always acted in good conscience? And his statement so angered this high priest that he commanded Paul to be smitten on the mouth, to slapped good across the mouth. Now Paul responded to that in very sharp words. God shall smite thee, thou whited wall, for sittest thou to judge me after the law, and commandest me to be smitten contrary to the law? Now, what the high priest had commanded to be done to Paul at this time was against the law. He was a high priest. He was supposed to know. And yet he had commanded this very thing that was in violation of the law. And there were some that stood by, unwilling to accept the error of Ananias, the high priest. There are always those who are willing to defend those in the wrong and attack those who are standing for the right. And in the fourth verse, some of them said to Paul, revilest thou God's high priest? Now notice Paul's statement. Paul said, I wist, or I knew not, brethren, that he was the high priest, for it is written, thou shalt not speak evil of the ruler of thy people. Was Paul admitting that he had done wrong here? Not in the least. Paul was indicting this high priest. In other words, he is saying in essence, well, how could you tell he's the high priest? He's sure not acting like a high priest. He's not obeying the law that's binding upon the high priest. How would anybody ever know that he was a high priest? And what it was here, his statement was a severe rebuke of the hypocrisy and duplicity of this so-called high priest here. Some have chastised Paul here by saying Paul got mad and lost his temper. Why, that's not it at all. Paul didn't get mad. Paul was always very much in control of himself. He didn't lose his temper. He knew what the law taught, but he also knew that this man was not acting like what the law taught. In fact, there's a real good reason to think that maybe the high priest was not even in all of his regalia that would have identified him in that office to begin with, and he didn't know who this man was, possibly, but he may have known who he was. But the man was not behaving in a proper fashion, and the Apostle Paul just let him know that he recognized he was not behaving in a proper fashion. Well, the Apostle Paul was very astute and very observant and very quick. And he looked out over this Sanhedrin, and it was composed primarily of two groups of people, two sects of the Jews, the Sadducees and the Pharisees. Now, ordinarily, the Pharisees and Sadducees were bitter enemies of one another. Religious enemies, political enemies. The Pharisees were a sect of people that more or less appealed to the common man. They were very strict pertaining to the law, very hypocritical in their own behavior, to be sure, but very strict and would bind the traditions of people as if they were the laws of God. The Sadducees, on the other hand, they were the ruling class. They were the elite. They were the aristocracy of the people. They were not the majority party, but they were the most powerful party. And they held the high priesthood, and they didn't believe in spirits, and they didn't believe in life after death. Of course, they didn't believe in the resurrection. And so there was this tension there in the Sanhedrin between these two groups. Now you will recall that even though these people were enemies one of another, they joined together in opposition against Christ. And they were about to join together here in the opposition of Paul. And Paul observed that they were some Sadducees and other were Pharisees. And so he said, men and brethren, I'm a Pharisee. I hold to a lot of the common things that Pharisees believe. I have the hope of Israel in my heart. I believe in the resurrection. I'm more like these than I am these over here. Paul used a weapon that always has a benefit to the one who uses it. Divide and conquer. You know, the devil can do that by dividing brethren. And brethren can do that by dividing their opponents. Paul divided this Sanhedrin here. He said, well, I'm more like this side than I am on that side. And when he said that, those of the Pharisees jumped up right quick and said, we don't see anything wrong with this man. I don't know how they could have come to that conclusion on just that basis unless they were so steeped in their hatred and their prejudices they just jumped to that conclusion immediately. But they were not about to condemn somebody that shared with them the idea of the resurrection, you see. Of course, they were right in what they held. The Sadducees were wrong. And Paul used that to his advantage. And so they cried out, this man had done no wrong, and we had just better not be against him, because if we don't watch out, we might find ourselves fighting against God. And there arose such a stir and a dissension, it's called here in verse 10, among this august body of Jewish leaders, that the chief captain, the Roman, had to intervene and to go in and again rescue Paul, lest they would have killed him right there on the spot. Now, can you imagine? Well, it'd be sort of hard to imagine. There were more than nine there, but there are nine on our Supreme Court. But can you imagine what sort of headlines and so forth it would, if someone would come before our Supreme Court and get them so riled up that they got ready to fight one another and getting ready to pounce on the person and just beat him to death? That would really make headlines in our country, wouldn't it? Why, how could anybody of that dignity and of that echelon of society, how could they stoop so low? Listen, people, when it comes to religious bigotry and prejudice, people can go to any depths that you've ever seen of horror. I've been studying recently or reviewing for the in view of the class that Brother Eves is going to be studying about religious history, church history. Every kind of crime imaginable has been perpetrated in the name of religion over the years. Even in the name of Christ, erroneously, of course. But this shows the attitude and the disposition of these people. And so the chief captain took Paul and took him out of that council and took him back to the castle, to the Roman headquarters. Paul was getting further and further and deeper into physical danger. Verse 11, in the night following, the Lord stood by him and said, be of good cheer, Paul, for as thou hast testified of me in Jerusalem, so must thou bear witness also at Rome. Now that would have been encouraging to him. Encouraging the fact that the Lord took note of what he was suffering. Encouraging the fact that he would not be killed here in Jerusalem. He would get out of Jerusalem. He would preach the gospel even in Rome, as he had intention to doing so. But Paul finally does get to Rome before the book of Acts is over, but he doesn't get there the way he'd anticipate. He doesn't get there the way that he thought that he might get there. But nonetheless, the Lord comforted him. Now, the next day, there were certain men, there were 40 of them, that conspired together. We've had all we want of this man Paul. And they agreed that they would neither eat or drink until, or at least they would eat nothing until they had killed Paul. And I think this is just downright funny. I just wondered what these fellows did because they didn't kill him. I wonder if they're still on a diet. They said, we're not going to eat until we kill. Well, that just shows the extent of the hatred against Paul and their determination to kill Paul. But they had a problem. Paul was in the Roman prison. How were they going to get to him? And so they made this plot. They came to the chief captain and he said, now, we want you to bring Paul. Their plot was to go to the chief captain and get him to bring Paul down again to the council. Get him out in the open. Get him away from the protection of a number of the Romans. Get him out here in the open, and while he's out in the open, we can assassinate him. And that wasn't a bad plan, if that's what the plan was, because they couldn't touch him while he was in jail. He was under protective custody. And so they were going to get him out in this fashion. Well, verse 16 tells us that Paul's sister's son, it'd be Paul's nephew, some way or another he heard about it. Now, I don't know how he happened to hear about it, but he heard about this plot. And so he went to where Paul was, and he told Paul about it. Well, Paul then called in one of the guards, and he said, take this lad to the chief captain. He's got something to say to him, and make sure he gets there and let him talk to him. And so the boy was taken to the chief captain. And there, the lad, Paul's nephew, revealed the plot that he had heard about among these 40 Jews to kill Paul. And to say, they're going to ask you to take him down to the council. And when you take him down to the council, they're going to take advantage of his openness and vulnerability there. And they're going to kill him. And so this was a very brave thing on the part of this lad. And the chief captain here acts very expeditiously, very wisely, very quickly. And he tells the lad, now don't you tell anybody what you've told me. And you just go on your way. But the chief captain destroyed that plot. He unraveled it before it took place. And the way that he did it was to take a couple of hundred soldiers. And in the middle of the night, he got Paul, and he escorted Paul out of Jerusalem. Now, can you imagine? 200 men. That's more than we've probably got here tonight. Every one of them a soldier. One lone prisoner. In the dead of night. I think that chief captain was very intent, was he not, to make sure Paul was not harmed. Keep in mind, he had a real good reason for this from his point of view. Paul was a Roman. Oh, how accountable he would have been if they had been able to slay a Roman that was under his protection. And so he accumulated this vast host of soldiers to escort Paul. And not only that, he had 70 other spearmen and 200 at the third hour. In other words, verse 32 tells us all about these men. And I had them all in mind as to how many there were. And I forgot the number, but you can add that up when you get time. But he had a great, great number of them. More than we ordinarily think would be expected. So Paul was provided beasts to ride on, and off they went to Caesarea. Now, Caesarea is northwest of Jerusalem, and Caesarea was where the prime Roman headquarters of Palestine was. So they took him up there to a man named Felix, who was the governor. Now, it's a very interesting portion in the last part of this chapter as to what this chief captain did. This chief captain's name is given here, Claudius Lysias. And he sent a letter along with Paul. And I want you to take note of this letter. It's a letter that is very self-serving. It doesn't tell the truth. It doesn't deal with the whole truth. It's a letter that just simply serves his own benefit. And so this is what he writes. Claudius Lysias, unto the most excellent governor Felix, sendeth greeting. This man was taken of the Jews, so far he's right, and should have been killed of them, so far he's right. Then came I with an army and rescued him. Bravo! What a wonderful, noble man. Having understood that he was a Roman. That's a lie. He didn't come down there to save Paul because he thought he was a Roman or had heard he was a Roman. He thought he was that Egyptian insurrectionist that we read about previously. But he couldn't tell him now. I was mistaken about who this guy was, and he just had to paint this thing so it'd make him look like the hero. And this is what he did, and he gets himself off pretty good. Nor in this letter does he say anything about while he was getting ready to scourge Paul before he found out that he was a Roman. Well, that wouldn't have been very good publicity for himself, would it? To tell the governor that I seized this man, I thought he was an Egyptian, come to find out he was a Roman, but before I beat him to death, I found out he was a Roman, and I was going to beat him. That wouldn't have sounded like he was handling things very well. So what does he do? Just like people today, they write letters, but they don't tell the whole truth, and it goes simply to serve their own purposes. And that's what Claudius Lysias did. Now, he went on to say here in verse 28, "And when I would have known the cause wherefore they accused him, I brought him forth unto their council." Now, this was right. "Whom I perceived to be accused of questions of their law." That was right. "But to have nothing laid to his charge worthy of death or of bonds." And that was right. So it was part true and part untrue. "And when it was told me how that the Jews laid wait for the man, I sent straightway to thee and gave commandment to his accusers also to say before thee what they had against him." Farewell. In other words, I found out about this plot, and that was right. "And when I found out about this plot, I acted," and he did wise there, "and I sent him to you. And I furthermore instructed those Jews, if you've got something to say against Paul, you go up to Caesarea and you go up here before Felix and you lay it out up there." And in those things, he acted not only wisely, but in the latter part there, he told the truth. And so the soldiers brought Paul to Antipatris. The next day, they went on to Caesarea and they took Paul up here to Felix. And when he came before Felix, Felix said, "I will hear thee, but we'll wait till your accusers come. We'll wait and just have all of this thing out in the open. We'll let you give answer to whatever charge is made. We'll wait till the chargers, however, get here first, and let them speak." And so he commanded Paul to be kept in a place, it's called Herod's Judgment Hall. No doubt this was some kind of confinement. It would not be the depths of prison or anything like that, but he was kept there waiting for the people of the Jews of Jerusalem to come before the Romans to make their accusations against him. And that's the way we find Paul in the situation we find him in as we conclude chapter 23. Well, brethren, it's been a long day for me, and I'm going to stop here with chapter 23, and I don't believe I'll make a single one of you mad by doing that. I've only known of one man that ever got upset at me for having a short lesson. And he told me about it, too. I had a short lesson one night, and I was going out, and he said, "You didn't preach long tonight." And I said, I know it. He said, "And I don't like that." And I thought, boy, that's nice. I'm glad to hear that. Until I found out why. He said, "I didn't get my nap out." Well, that's not the reason that I'm turning off a little short here tonight. I think that the end of the chapter is a good time. Furthermore, that we could not cover all of the next chapter in the time allotted. So 2 weeks from tonight, after what we trust will be a successful gospel effort, we're going to have Paul as he begins his defenses before the Roman authorities. He had stood before a crowd, a mob. He'd stood before the Sanhedrin, he had escaped a plot, and now he's going to be called upon to give answer to more than one Roman authority for his conduct and his behavior. Lord willing, we'll study the 24th chapter then at the next appropriate time. I think we have to be impressed, do we not, brethren, as we read of these events, and as we look at this marvelous man of God, how much suffering he had caused in time past to those who were of the faith, but how much he was suffering also because he upheld the faith. And he endured so much because he knew what he preached was God's word. God had revealed it to him, and he knew it was the truth. He loved that truth more than anything, and he loved the souls of those people, Jew and Gentile, to whom he taught, and he was willing to take whatever came his way as a consequence for standing firm. And oh, he had to take such an awful lot, didn't he? Nothing like anything. We don't have anything like that. Not in our day, in this country of freedom. We don't have to suffer anything that could even be rightly compared to what these noblemen of time past readily and willingly endured for the cause of Christ. Because of that, we know that they died for something true. They lived for something that's true. And we would persuade you to accept it as God's truth, for it is. And to come to the Christ that Paul preached through obedience to his gospel, faith, repentance, confession, and baptism. And rise from those watery graves, being washed clean by the blood of Christ, to live a faithful life in Christ, to live life in hope, and to die with expectation that heaven will be your home. If you're subject to the invitation of Christ tonight, we invite you to come.